Welcome, welcome to the special one-time edition of the True Animal Lovers podcast. Get it, animal lovers? I'm Christina, and with me today are Natalie and Alessia. We're all third-year law students at Thompson Rivers University in Kamloops, BC. Today we'll be discussing some topics that we think are in the public interest that relate to animal law. We'll be talking about pets and family law, animals and zoos, and finally we'll be touching on the horse slaughter industry in Canada. We hope that this podcast not only increases your knowledge and awareness for these issues, but also inspires you to get out and learn a little bit more about them and do your part in making a difference in the lives of animals. First, I'm going to turn it over to Natalie to talk about pets and animal law. Over to you, Natalie.
Thank you, Christina. So today I am going to be talking about pets and family law disputes. So specifically, I'm going to look at the question, are the best interests of pets taken into consideration by Canadian courts and family law proceedings? So this is an area of law that has become increasingly more common in the past 20 years. And I say this for the following three reasons. Number one, the number of pets owned by Canadians is increasing. According to a survey conducted by a company called GFK in 2016, 61% of Canadians own pets. Number two, Canadians are now having fewer children than they were 50 years ago. Pets are now becoming people's children. And finally, the divorce rate in Canada is high. So statistics show that 4 in 10 marriages in Canada end in divorce. So it's really a combination of these three factors that result in a greater number of family law disputes making its way into the courtroom. So before I get into my question of whether or not the best interests of pets are taken into consideration by a court, I want to provide a brief overview as to how animals are treated under the law. So there is this long-standing notion that animals are classified as property under the law, and we can see this from the early case of Rogers and Rogers. In that case, the District Court of Ontario held that a domestic animal is a personal chattel and subject of absolute property. So how does this apply to family law? How does family law legislation, such as the BC Family Law Act, deal with property? Well, in BC, under the Family Law Act, property can fall into one of two categories. It can either fall under family property under Section 84 of the FLA, or excluded property under Section 85 of the FLA. Now, family property is any property that was acquired during the course of a marriage-like relationship, whereas excluded property was property that was owned by one of the parties prior to entering into that marriage-like relationship. So these two categories of property are really important when it comes to division of property. So when a marriage-like relationship ends, family property is divided 50-50. With excluded property, though, because it was held by one of the parties prior to entering into that relationship, when a marriage relationship ends, that property belongs to the individual who owned it initially. There is a rule that talks about, you know, when the property increases in value, the couples will split any increase in equity, but I'm not going to get into that too much today. And looking at these categories of property and property division, it's important to note that this is not unique to BC. Legislation in other provinces, such as Alberta, deal with this under the Matrimonial Property Act. So I've looked at the categories of property, and I've looked at division of property, but how do these provisions apply to family pets? Because, you know, when parties separate, they're typically not going to physically divide their pets in half. Parties typically also do not want to sell their pets and split the proceeds. So how do courts deal with this? Well, with excluded property, it's fairly simple. Courts have typically found that those who have owned a pet prior to entering into a marriage-like relationship are the sole owners of that pet and are therefore entitled to keep the pet following the end of relationship. And we see this from a couple cases such as Thompson and Thompson and Brown and La Rochelle. With regards to family property, though, it's a little bit different. So courts are rarely going to order that the parties share the family pet 50-50. Therefore, the question that is typically asked by courts is, who has a better claim in ownership? And there are a few Canadian cases that shed some light on as to what ownership entails. So we see a case that stems from the Court of Queen's Bench of Saskatchewan in 2010, and this case is Ireland and Ireland. And in this case, the court looked at a couple of factors in regards to ownership. The first one was who primarily trains and cares for the animal, who has bonded to the animal more, does one of the parties still benefit from the presence and companionship of other animals, In 2007, the Ontario Superior Court of Justice in Grimblake and Concios looked at, you know, who has the pet lived with following separation, and who cared for the pet during this time. Other factors that a court may look at in determining ownership are who paid for the majority of expenses related to the pet. So as you can see, you know, these are a lot of questions to consider, and you can imagine that bringing a matter such as this before a court is not only going to cost parties a lot of money, but it's going to take up a lot of time, and it's therefore better for them to mutually come to a decision and draft up a separation agreement that reflects both of their interests. So now I'm going to get back to my core question that I asked at the beginning. And the question is, are the best interests of pets taken into account by a court in family law proceedings? Now, based on my previous discussions of pets as property under the law, it does not come as a surprise that the answer to this question is no. There is no family law legislation currently in Canada that considers the best interests of pets, although there have been some cases where courts have considered the best interests, such as the recent case of Brown and La Rochelle, but again, this is not reflected in family law legislation here in Canada.
Natalie, if it was reflected in the legislation, would it be up to the judge to make the determination of what's in the best interest of the pet or some other body or person?
I think it would definitely be up to the judge to make this decision. You know, arguably the judge is a neutral third party who's going to consider the evidence before him or her and come to that decision. And also, as I will discuss later on, there is legislation in other jurisdictions that requires courts to consider, you know, the well-being of pets. And so I think that maybe in order to keep things consistent, I think it would be up to the judge, and for sure. So yeah, as I was mentioning, there is no legislation that requires courts to consider the best interests. So, you know, the question becomes, well, should the best interests of pets be taken into account? And I think, you know, my opinion to this is that yes, family law legislation across Canada should be amended to include a provision that requires courts to consider the best interests of family pets. And at the very least, if we're not to, you know, include a best interest provision, we should have a well-being or, you know, the conditions a provision, which require a lower standard, but would still require courts to sort of look at the overall well-being of pets. And I think we should amend our legislation, and I say this for two reasons. Number one, this would not come as a shock to Canadians. So, you know, most pet owners in Canada love their pets. And I guarantee that if you were to ask the majority of pet owners here in Canada the question, you know, should your pet receive the best care possible at all times? I guarantee that the answer to that question would be yes. And in my opinion, I don't think this question is any different than should the best interests of pets be taken into consideration by a court in family law proceedings. And the second reason I think our legislation should be amended is that, you know, it would not be the first time something like this has happened. And I specifically want to look at the jurisdictions, both Illinois as well as Switzerland.
Hey, Natalie. So my question is, do you think that this protection for pets in family law would be better suited, or will get to the point of like child protection almost under that act?
I think that's what we want in the long run, but I think first we need to, you know, amend our legislation to consider at least something, right? As I said earlier, either the best interest or if not, the well-being or the overall conditions, which is a lower standard. I mean, I think that absolutely that's something that would be great in the long run, but I think that initial first step is we need to include some sort of provision that looks at pets' overall conditions. And so, yeah, as I was mentioning, both Illinois in the U.S. as well as Switzerland have legislation that has something to this effect. So I specifically want to look at the Public Act in Illinois. Specifically, it's Public Act 100-0422. And Section 503N of the Act states that if the court finds that a companion animal of the parties is a marital asset, it shall allocate the sole or joint ownership of and responsibility for a companion animal of the parties. In issuing an order under this subsection, the court shall take into consideration the well-being of the companion animal. So, you know, although the term best interest is not being used here, and the pets are still considered an asset under the Act, this is definitely a step in the right direction. Now, I also want to just briefly look at Switzerland. Section 651A1 of the Swiss Civil Code states that, you know, in simple terms, that ownership is determined based on who will offer or provide the better conditions of the pet. So again, you know, the best interests are not being considered here, but it nonetheless requires courts to consider the overall conditions of the pet. So I think that, you know, looking at both of these acts in Illinois and Switzerland, although they're not perfect and they still have a long ways to go, it's better than what we're doing here in Canada.
What do you think will happen in scenarios where both owners appear to be equally as good pet owners? Would it, we end up going down the road of maybe a custody agreement, 50-50 ownership, or do you think the courts in the long run will just make one determination, it goes to this person, and that's that?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. Courts are hesitant to want to divide a pet 50-50 between the owners, and this is because, you know, when they make their decision, they want that decision to be final. They don't want to have an issue where, say, in 5 years down the road, the parties are back in court because they're fighting over who gets the dog on this weekend or who gets the dog on that weekend. And so it's definitely, you know, the court wants to make a final decision. But that's why, you know, as I was mentioning earlier, if parties can really sit down and deal with something like this amicably and write up a separation agreement that reflects both of their interests, then they can absolutely, you know, divide the pet 50-50. Well, thank you very much for listening. I'm now going to pass it over to Alessia.
Thanks, Natalie. So I'm Alessia, and today I'm going to be talking about animals held in captivity in zoos and why zoos aren't being held liable for animal distress. And I think the starting point of the story begins with Lucy, who is the Asian elephant that has been at the center of legal action in Edmonton, Alberta. The case is called Reese and Edmonton, and basically Reese and some other organizations brought this forward to the court, and they claimed that the Edmonton Zoo was in breach of the animal distress provision. So a little background to this is that elephants are very social beings. They are large-brained animals and require some level of socializing day-to-day, especially female elephants who actually develop and maintain very close relationships with other female elephants, so mothers, daughters, even female cousins. And unfortunately, Lucy is being held alone and in captivity in a very small space. So now her mental health is very not doing well, and her physical health is also kind of in shambles. She suffers from arthritis, she's obese, and she has foot infections. So like I said, Reese brings it to the court, and unfortunately, the court dismisses the action based on a procedural basis that Reese and the organizations brought this forward, trying to enforce the criminal law privately, and for any non-lawyers, that you can't do that. So we never really got a substantial decision on the merits of the case. So then the issue here is, are zoos held liable to animal distress provisions? And before I go into that, there is animal distress provisions in the BC Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act under Section 9, which basically says any person who has an animal is responsible for that animal, must care for them and protect them, and most importantly, they must not cause or permit the animal to be in distress. However, the next question is then, why are zoos even around? Because clearly they're causing distressed animals. So unfortunately, in the act, there's also an immunity-like exemption to zoos, which states that any distress that results from activities that are carried out in accordance with reasonable and generally accepted practices of animal management are excused. Basically. So the issue here is that zoos can keep animals in these sad and dismal states. And unfortunately, because the act is silent on what reasonable and generally accepted practices of animal management is, so long as they are conforming to what the rest of Canadian zoos are doing, everything is fine.
So Alessia, does that mean that if all zoos are treating elephants this way, keeping them kind of segregated and isolated, it pretty much makes it okay?
Exactly. That's exactly it, Christina. This is a very low threshold, and you can see the exact same wording in many of the acts across Canada. In Alberta, for example, Section 2 says the exact same thing in that, you know, a distress from activities carried out in accordance with the regulations or what is reasonable and generally accepted excuses this distress, basically. And the same is said in the Saskatchewan one. And basically, so long as animals are, you know, so long as zoos are keeping their animals in the same states as everyone else, they're fine. So, and that really isn't the only issue here, because there's also public interest factors that arise from zoos, and zoo advocates will typically say that zoos are kept for education and research. However, I've done a little bit of research into this, and it doesn't seem that that's the case, because a lot of the time, how can you do research on animals that are acting abnormally? And that's the case here. And a lot of advocates will say that's exaggerated. Animals in captivity aren't typically acting abnormally. But my question to them is it? Because, for example, Lucy was not sleeping properly and she was having foot infections, which caused her to lay down more and not walk as much as typical elephants would do. And I would say that that is abnormal for an elephant. So how can we say that we're doing research on animals that aren't acting like typical animals? And the same can be said for education. We bring our children to the zoos, and, you know, and we want them to see the animals up close and this magic. But at the same time, should we not teach children that these animals are actually suffering, and that if we truly want to appreciate wildlife, we should allow these animals to be in their free state?
Yeah, I have a question. I agree that, you know, it would be a good thing for parents to stop taking their children to the zoos. But is there anything that sort of we as Canadians can do beyond that?
You know, we can. I think the easiest answer to that is that we can go to our MPs. We can continue to advocate for, you know, animals to be not seen as property. And I think that's the general big picture here, is that because animals are seen as property, we can basically do whatever. However, I think that the general public, yeah, it's just about, you know, not buying tickets to zoos. You know, we start educating children. And ultimately, I think a lot of it is coming down to this economic factor, because ultimately zoos are for entertainment. They are keeping animals for the pleasure of humans, and it's a money-making business. And if we stop going to zoos, but we take our children to, you know, whale watching and take them to Banff and you see actual natural wildlife, it would be better. And I think on like a bigger scale, we also have the new introduction of the S-203 bill that is currently in the Senate, and it's the first step towards ending zoos. This bill is currently advocating for ending the captivity of whales and dolphins. And much like elephants, they're very social beings, and keeping them segregated and keeping them in captivity is doing them more harm than good. And this bill is advocating for the end of that. And that's just one small step towards abolishing zoos. And I guess my last point here is that, you know, we just continue educating ourselves. We reach out to our MPs and we do the best we can to advocate for animals. And yeah, I think I'm going to throw it over to Christina to educate us a little bit on horse slaughter in Canada.
Thank you, Alessia. That was really informative. I actually didn't know that much about animals kept in zoos in this country. I'm going to move on and talk about another sort of upsetting topic, so beware. I'm going to be talking about the horse slaughter industry in Canada. First things first, yes, it is legal to slaughter horses for meat consumption in this country. I think that's a little known fact. I certainly didn't know it. So let's get that out of the way. It's legal. It happens in this country. Most of this horse meat is exported to the European Union and also Asia, but some does stay for consumption by Canadians in Quebec primarily. So horses are not only slaughtered in Canada, but we also export them to other countries for slaughter. I'm going to be focusing more on talking about slaughtering horses in Canada, but I just want to take time to note that exporting horses for slaughter also raises a number of issues related to animal cruelty issues. And this really surrounds like how these horses are transported. I really encourage anyone who's interested to look up online a little bit more about this. There's some great articles by Vice and Global about this.
So before diving into discussion on why you should care that horses are being slaughtered in Canada, I just want to give you some background on the industry. So in 2007, the United States decided to ban horse slaughtering in that country. This had the effect of ramping up slaughter facilities in Canada and Mexico. So typically what happens now in Canada is horses are either imported from the United States to be slaughtered or sometimes purchased at auctions here in Canada. Currently, we have 4 federally registered horse slaughterhouses, 2 in Alberta, 1 in, and 2 in Quebec, sorry. We used to actually have 5. The 5th was located near us at Thompson Rivers here. It's near Kamloops. It was KLM Meat Processors, but they had their license suspended last year for issues related to ineffective stunning of the animals prior to slaughter. And I did recently look online to double check to make sure they hadn't had their license given back to them recently, and no, they're still not listed as a federally registered horse slaughter facility. And all these facilities have to comply with the Meat Inspection Act and the Meat Inspection Regulations, and it's the Canadian Food Inspection Agency who oversees these facilities and has the power to revoke licenses for violations of any of the act or regulations.
Yeah, I just have a quick question. So you were mentioning earlier about the horses here in Canada and how they are sold at auctions. So am I correct in saying that these horses are not bred specifically for the purpose of meat or being exported for meat?
Yeah, that's 100% correct, Natalie. And that is really one of the crux of this issue and why you should care is because horses are not raised for human consumption as opposed to cows and pigs. And I'm going to dive into that a little bit more in a second, but that in turn makes the meat potentially unsafe for human consumption and is a major concern. And just kind of to give you guys an idea of how big this industry is, in 2006, there were approximately 54,000 horses slaughtered in this country, which is a lot. Like, think of how big horses are. That's a lot of meat. And I've read estimates that indicate that the industry is valued at about $80 million, depending on each year. There's influxes, but it's not an insignificant industry. It certainly doesn't touch the cow or pig industry, but it's definitely not insignificant. So now I just want to kind of go back and discuss a little bit more about why you should care about this industry, care about this issue. Now, first off, I think most people will support the ending of horse slaughter in this country because of this inherent sort of yuck factor. And that's because we tend to view horses as pets here. Most people don't know we're slaughtering them for meat consumption. And people don't like slaughtering animals that we think are pets. And I think we can all see that from the recent story about the pig Molly, who was adopted from the SPCA as a pet and her owner slaughtered her. And it created this outrage because we just inherently don't kill our pets and eat them. We think it's wrong. Now, the problem with this argument is it may be a little bit hypocritical to say it's okay to kill one animal and not the other. So I actually think that the main reason we should be focusing on to end the slaughter industry isn't related to the fact that horses are pets. It actually has to do with the safety of the meat. And that's something Natalie was touching on when she asked about where these horses are coming from. So the problem here is horses are not raised for meat consumption as opposed to other animals. And this raises issues because of any sort of medications or drugs horses are given during their lifetime that are potentially dangerous for humans if they're consumed. And I think a primary example of this is this drug. It has a fancy like medical name, but it's commonly known as Bute. And it's so common in horses. Like, I used a horseback ride and all the horses had Bute. It's this anti-inflammatory drug. And I was reading online and one expert compared it to the use of Tylenol in humans. Like, if you go around and ask humans, have you had Tylenol? Most of us have had Tylenol in our lifetime. Most horses get Bute in their lifetime. So, and the Canadian Food Inspection Agency has a zero tolerance for Bute given to animals. So that means if an animal has ever been given Bute, they're deemed unsafe by the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. So then this begs the question of, if these horses are being bought at auctions and they were pets and a lot of them are retired racehorses, people's old horses, they were more than likely given Bute and we're slaughtering them and we're eating the meat. Isn't this unsafe? And the answer I think is yes. Like, how can it not be? The Canadian Food Inspection Agency says Bute cannot be given to animals. They're meant for human consumption. And Bute is really just one example of a dangerous medication or drug that is unsafe for human consumption. There's so many others that raise issues because people who have horses as pets are not making decisions about their medical care thinking, this horse is going to end up on someone's dinner plate, so I shouldn't give them XYZ drugs. It'll be dangerous. No one's thinking that. And these decisions aren't being made, which are made in relation to, let's say, a cow who's being raised in a slaughter facility. The owners make decisions about what they feed those animals based on Canadian Food Inspection Agency guidelines. So interestingly, there has been two recent changes to laws abroad that may impact this industry. And I'm going to get to those in a second, but I want to talk about one sort of attempt to end this industry in Canada. And that was in 2014 with the introduction of Bill C-571. Now, it was introduced and the bill essentially ensured that the only horses that would be slaughtered in Canada would be the ones that had a lifetime medical record indicating that they had never received any treatment that would be detrimental to human consumption of the meat. So if a horse had ever received treatment of Bute or any other drugs listed on the Canadian Food Inspection Agency's website, they couldn't be killed for slaughter. Unfortunately, this bill failed. I read through some of the information available online about the parliamentary debates, and there's kind of this discussion about whether or not the bill would impact interprovincial movement of horses, but I really think it was all kind of, that wasn't the real issue at the end of the day. The real issue was going to be that this bill would kill the horse slaughter industry in Canada, because no horse is going to have a lifetime medical record, and even if they do, there's no way it's going to indicate they never received a drug that would be dangerous for human consumption. So then what are we killing? We can't kill any of the horses. So it would just totally kill the industry.
Christina, I'm just really struggling with why we have this industry in Canada when very few provinces eat horse meat. Why don't we just, collapse the industry and ship and just leave it to Mexico, really, to do the horse slaughtering? Because we clearly, as Canadians, aren't really advocating for this kind of industry.
I think that's a really good point, and I think it raises some ethical questions about if Canadians don't support the slaughter of horses and we're not primarily consuming this meat, why are we doing it? I really think it comes down to some powerful people who are making decisions. The farming industry and the slaughter industry are pretty powerful, and to be honest, I have heard arguments raise that if we collapse our horse slaughter industry, that means more horses will be slaughtered in Mexico. And there are some potential concerns about the slaughter methods in Mexico. I've read some articles and I'm not sure that their methods are nearly as humane as they are in Canada. So you could argue that more horses will be slaughtered inhumanely if Canada ends our horse slaughter. Having said that, I don't think that's a viable reason to keep up with the horse slaughter. I don't think because they would do it worse, we should be doing it, is a sound argument, but it certainly is one that's being advanced by some critics out there. And there, just to touch on a couple of recent changes abroad, in 2017, actually, a bill was introduced in the United States which would label horse meat as unsafe to consume and also prohibit the export of horses for slaughter to foreign countries. So this bill hasn't passed yet. It's still going through the Senate. I can't really tell if it will be successful, but if it is, this would have a huge impact on our industry and potentially kill it, because I've read estimates that put between 60 to 70% of all horses being slaughtered in this country are coming from the United States. So if this bill makes it so that they can't even export horses to be slaughtered here, that would really stifle the industry and would probably mark its end days, I think. And then in addition, last year, the European Union put restrictions on horse meat imports from Canada. So what the European Union says now is that horse meat that's being imported into the European Union has to have a residency of 6 months in the country it came from. So that means if we're importing horses from the United States, we have to keep them in Canada for 6 months and have a 6-month medical record before we slaughter them and export the meat. And this really came down to the European Union having problems with concerned about contamination from some of these drugs I mentioned earlier. And they're trying to crack down and say, we want to ensure the horses aren't given drugs that are dangerous for human consumption. It's a step in the right direction, but again, it's only a 6-month period. And the Canadian Food Inspection Agency has a zero tolerance policy for these drugs. So 6 months, I don't think it's enough, but it's certainly moving towards a direction of more regulation and being stricter on the industry, which is a good sign. So I just kind of want to end this sort of segment by talking about how even if you don't support ending the slaughter of horses in this country for animal welfare or cruelty reasons, which I get, not everyone feels the same way, you should support it because of the safety reasons I talked about today. Horse meat is not safe to consume. We're not raising these animals to be consumed by humans. There's so many issues surrounding this. And so I just encourage everyone to take some time, look up more information on this issue, do your research. You know, given the limited amount of time we have had today, we haven't been able to really dive deep into all these issues, but I think all three of us would encourage anyone to look up some more on these topics. I know for my topic about horse slaughter, there's some amazing investigations into some of the facilities in Canada and their inhumane treatment of animals. So go online, look it up, educate yourself before making a decision on this matter. And I hope that you reach the same conclusion as I do, that we need to end the horse slaughter industry in Canada.
So that about wraps it up for us today. Again, this is Alessia sitting here with Natalie and Christina coming at you from TRU Law, 3L students. And ultimately, we encourage you to educate yourselves about these very real issues in animal law.
And I think just adding on to what Alessia said, all three of our topics today, whether we think they directly impact our lives or not, they are going to have, you know, some sort of effect either in our lives or in the lives of someone we know. So if you have questions, Google, I mean, ask these questions, be aware, research. And I think those are all important things that we can do. So thank you again for listening.